Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Mick Clifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, many of you will be aware Ian Bailey, the chief suspect in the murder of Sophie Toscan du Plantier way back in 1996, died this week at the age of 66. He was subsequently cremated in Cork at a ceremony that was reportedly attended only by officials from the crematorium. Mr. Bailey was a highly controversial figure. He was arrested twice for the murder of Miss Duplantier, and he was also prosecuted for assaulting his partner at the time, Jules Thomas. Their 30-year relationship ended in 2021. Many people, I think it's fair to say, are convinced that Bailey was guilty of murder. Many others say that he was the victim of Garda malpractice, in which he was effectively framed. It should be said that Bailey took a civil action against the state for wrongful arrest, which he lost. That was one of the longest running civil actions in the history of the state. Now, one major bone of contention for some is that Bailey was never actually charged with the murder, despite the Gardaí compiling a huge file on him and the DPP considering at least three times whether he should be prosecuted. And each time the DPP decided against it. One person who believes that he should have been charged is my guest today. Nick Foster is a journalist who has written a detailed account of the case and particularly the evidence against Bailey. Murder at Roaring Bay, the inside story of the death of Sophie Toscan du Plantier, is the title of Nick's book. I have to say it has to be recommended to anybody who has an interest in this case. Nick, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mick. Thanks very much for having me. Good morning.
Nick, first of all, could I ask you how you came to the case?
Well, I first heard about the case in 1997. I was living in Belgium at the time. That's where I live now. And I heard about it on the TV news in French. And what I remember was images of Ian Bailey being arrested and the sense, the fairly clear sense from French news, that this emerging story would reach a fairly rapid conclusion. I mean, clearly, after all these years, it didn't. But that was certainly what I felt and what I understood when I first heard about the case. After that, I got involved in other true crime stories, and fast forward a little bit to 2014, so just under 10 years ago, when, as you'll remember, when Mr. Bailey sued the Irish state and the Garda Síochána, and Irish friends in Brussels, where I was living, said to me, "You've really got to look at this case. It's the Sophie Toscan du Plantier case. It's notorious in Ireland. A lot of people are talking about it, particularly now because it's in the news." And I found out that Mr. Bailey was going to take the stand at the Four Courts, and I think that was on a Thursday or a Friday. And I booked a ticket immediately to come to Dublin. I was determined to see him under cross-examination in a courtroom, and I thought that it would be an experience that would tell me if I could write a newspaper or a magazine feature on the story, because that's what I was thinking of doing at the beginning, was simply to write a fairly short piece on the story. And I realized that there was so much more to it. The seeing Mr. Bailey take the stand, it was so fascinating. And I realized that the story was, as it had been advertised, let's say, a big one.
Yeah, so you saw him take the stand there and your interest obviously grew. I mean, I'd have to say myself, I remember that occasion when he took the stand in the civil action, and it was very interesting. But just for my own interest in the case, roll it back 11 years and he took the stand in a libel action in Cork in 2003. And I have to say he was eviscerated by the senior counsel for the newspapers, Paul Gallagher, who went on to be an attorney general. And I think an awful lot of people would have come away from that libel action in particular believing that Bailey had definitely some involvement in the murder of Sophie Toscan du Plante. However, that it was a civil case and that was people's opinions, and that doesn't say anything. But from your point of view, just go through this first of all. So you got an interest in, and you met Bailey, and did you get to know him?
I did. I met Bailey at the Four Courts. So I was sitting, perhaps with you as well, on the press benches, watching this this man given an explanation of the reason why he was taking the guards and the Irish state to court. And I have to say as well, the first impression that I got was, and it was a very clear impression, was that he was enjoying it, that he was enjoying the spectacle, he was enjoying being the centre of attention. I thought that the case that he was bringing was rather flimsy. What was more interesting was the way that he was presenting himself, the way that he used humour, the way that he portrayed himself as the kind of little guy fighting for justice. The way that he tried to convince everybody in the courtroom, and we played to the public gallery, but in a way that seemed to make sense. You know, he portrayed himself as the little guy fighting the whole machinery of a Western European state. But here's the thing, when he wasn't taking the stand, I was also looking at him, and he just looked bored. And even when, for instance, his partner, Jules Thomas, was under cross-examination, I caught him yawning a few times. And I thought, this is very strange. He seems to withdraw from the proceedings when he's not the center of attention. So that was fascinating. It wasn't at all difficult, of course, to introduce myself to Ian Bailey during a recess. And within a few days, we had dinner together with Jules Thomas. I had the chance to get to know him a bit more. And I realized that you know, as plenty of Irish friends have been telling me, this was a big, complicated case. It was fascinating. But I also knew that if I was going to research it, I had to get an invitation back to the Prairie near Skull, where Bailey lived. And I had to try to research the story from the inside out. Because I'm an outsider, and I got so much from your reporting, Mick, so much from Ralph's reporting, Ralph Regal, Senator Maloney. You were the guys on the ground. You followed the case. I was an outsider. I'd never been to Ireland before. I'd been to the north once. But the day I flew into Dublin to rush to the Four Courts to sit on the press bench was the first time I'd been to the Republic. So I was absolutely an outsider. I was here to learn. Not just about the case, obviously, that was the main thing, but also about the context of the case, the criminal justice system in your country. And I knew that if I was going to add any kind of value to the story in the form of a book, for instance, it would be because I wanted to get close to Bailey, and I wanted to tell the story from his domestic setting outwards, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And your point about the outsider is very well made too, Nick, because I think it's fair to say that very often in cases like this or other cases, somebody coming in completely with clean hands, so to speak, a fresh eyes, can often give a perspective that those who are around it too close, or, you know, we all form unconscious biases or whatever as time goes on. So that's definitely interesting. Now, in getting to know Bailey, as I understand it, he agreed at one point to give you, he had the Garda file on him, and he agreed to give you that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I realised that if I was going to make any headway at all, I needed the witness statements that were in what Bailey immemorably called 2,000 pages of rumours. That's what how he termed it in the Four Courts. But I needed to see that. And there was no way forward for me, realistically, without managing to see the case against Ian Bailey as it was in the Garda file. The Garda file contains something like 670 witness statements, and I find it fascinating to try to kind of create a narrative out of that and to put it together, because the witness statements are listed in alphabetical order. You have to establish for yourself the chronology. You have to establish for yourself the you'd have to fit it all together, the value of the witness statements. I mean, clearly not all of them were important, but some of them were very important. Sometimes witnesses were interviewed 4, 5, 6, even 7 times over. But it was my job to put all that together and to make sense of it. And took me a while, but I certainly got to the position where I thought, you know what, the evidence in this Garda file is really very strong. I would say there were two main areas where it was strong. The scratches on Bailey's hands and a gash on his forehead that he had hours after the murder. Didn't have, you know, any of that before. And he went to a bar, he was playing a drum night before the murder. There are plenty of witnesses, half a dozen witnesses, in fact, who say no, he didn't have any scratches visible that evening. And that was mere hours before the crime. There's also a raft of evidence that suggests Bailey knew about the crime before he was officially informed. And I think that the detail of that evidence, first of all, it's absolutely fascinating, but it's also something that made me think, you know what, this should go to trial. It's substantial enough to go to trial. And it's absolutely right that it should have been a jury of Irish women and Irish men who decided on the guilt or innocence of Ian Bailey. And I think we've got to the point where, because there wasn't a trial in Ireland, you have these documentaries, you have several books that came out, well, there's mine, Ralph Regal's, Mick Sheridan as well, a good friend of mine. All of this happened because there wasn't a trial in Ireland. And I think that this whole case could have been and should have been put to bed, you know, several short years after the murder happened.
Fair point, Nick, in terms of those threads. And yes, there is that evidence in relation to the scratches. There were witnesses in the pub who said there was no scratches. He was playing the Bowron, I think it was, that night, something he took great... He took great pleasure in doing. And also in terms of telling people before he was officially to know, that's also the case. I mean, I know one of those people, for instance, was a friend of his whose brother I happened to know. And Bailey phoned him at a time that he estimated, he subsequently gave evidence at the libel trial, that he estimated was earlier than the time that Bailey said he knew of the killing. And that was one of a number of instances like that. Now, as you say, that is a certain level of evidence. However, the strongest thread that the Gardaí had in terms of pinning Bailey to the murder was this sighting by a woman, Maria Farrell, on the road at about 2 a.m. in the morning of the murder. It was at a point that was not directly in the line between Sophie Tuscan Duplantier's home and Bailey's, but... you know, it was a plausible route, albeit a bit roundabout. And Maria Farrell contacted the Gardaí and claimed to have seen him. Now, I think it's fair to say, Nick, that evidence has been discredited to a large extent over the years, not least through Maria Farrell's own testimony subsequently.
That's absolutely the case. And you know what? I mean, I've been critical of the DPP in the way that they came to their conclusions on the Garda file, particularly with respect to Bailey's confessions, which we can come to. But as far as Marie Farrell's concerned, and as far as the evidence that she, her own testimony, that the DPP examined, as far as that's concerned, the DPP is, you know, was bang on the money. The evidence that Marie Farrell could have, let's say, brought to the courthouse was, if Bailey had been put on trial for murder, would have been problematic because we didn't know, still got no way of knowing, what the passenger in Marie Farrell's car saw that night. Marie Farrell was absolutely clear that she wasn't on her own in the car, as she was driving towards Kilfada Bridge, direction Skull. She was there with somebody. What did he see? Did he see anything at all? Did he see Ian Bailey? Did he see somebody else? And so the DPP, I think, was absolutely right to say, you know what, there's a problem. There's an inherent problem in this piece of testimony. And I thought it was really interesting. We were both there in Paris at the trial in France. I think it was really interesting that the French prosecutor did choose to make something of that original Marie Farrell evidence. Do you remember? And that was included in the case against Ian Bailey, and I felt that that was possibly a mistake. What the value of Marie Farrell's evidence is a bit difficult to ascertain over all these years. She's retracted it. You recall she stormed out of a courtroom once. She said in open court that she confuses fact or has confused fact and fiction. So at this point, it's difficult to know what to make of it. However, I was a little bit surprised that the prosecution in Paris at the trial there that Mr. Bailey chose not to attend, I was rather surprised that they used that as not a significant plank of the evidence against Bailey, but as part of the evidence against him. And I thought that was one of the strange things, let's say. That was one of the strange things.
Yeah, well, I have to say, and both yourself and myself attended that trial, Nick, and I have to say myself, I didn't think it was strange to this extent. There was so much that was strange about that trial. To me, it fitted into a pattern. But we'll come to that trial in a minute. But just going back again to, and going back to your point about your belief the DPP should have prosecuted. So what we're talking about, to the largest extent, we're not going into the specific detail, but just to run this by you, we're talking about the scratches, where they came from. We're talking about the fact that he appears to have contacted people before. He said he knew that there had been a murder, claiming that there had been a murder, which would suggest knowledge that he hadn't let on before. And there were a few people in that category, even though it was difficult to prove it beyond witness testimony because there was no digital technology with phones or whatever. But that is evidence of itself. And the third strand is that he said to a number of people afterwards that he did it, including a 14-year-old boy he gave a lift to, and including a couple he was at a party with, and everybody had an awful lot of drink taken. Now, in broad terms, Nick, are those the elements, or am I missing out on anything else as well there that would have been in that file that would have gone towards his guilt?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's obviously the question of his alibi as well, which was non-existent. And it was rather, it's remarkable that he can't account for around about 7 hours of his movements on that night. And that makes him an absolute outlier in West Cork when the guards were doing their housewives inquiries, when they were figuring out where men who were young, middle-aged, where they were. I mean, just about everybody had an alibi. They were kind of tucked up in bed, you know, but he wasn't. So there's that side as well. But just get back to the confessions. I think that this is really the key point, and it's absolutely the difference between the position that the French court took. It's the French court, but also the ASOF, so the Sophie Justice Committee. They had access to the files as well. So Sophie's family, and on the one hand, and the DPP on the other. I think this is where the DPP made a significant mistake. So just to give you a bit of context, the DPP received from the guards, I think it was a single tape of Bailey speaking. It was a tape that they'd got from a French journalist who asked Bailey a number of questions. She taped the replies, and the DPP found that Bailey speaking on this, I think, single tape, they found that he was, quote, credible and convincing. And that seems very odd that they should come to that conclusion on the basis of, I think, just one tape. On the other hand, and just to contrast that, if we come to the confessions, one of the confessions concerned a gentleman called Shelley. And the DPP found that his evidence was, quote, dangerously unreliable. And I found that such a strange difference to take, you know, such a strange position to come to on the basis of evidence that at first sight seems pretty damning. So the confessions, I think, should have been a matter for an Irish jury. They should have been a matter for an Irish jury. What I think the DPP did was that it jumped in and it kind of jumped ahead of itself, and it kind of took decisions which I think were properly the decisions of Irish women and Irish men in an Irish jury in a trial on Irish soil. As far as I'm concerned, and again, I think that this is what certainly came out of the French trial. One area where I do agree with them is that words have meanings. It's absolutely clear to me that Bailey was confessing, for instance, when he gave a lift home to the 14-year-old boy, and he reported that Bailey said to him that he'd gone up there. Well, I mean, I'll spare your listeners the graphic description of that Bailey gave, but he went up there to the house and bashed her head in with a rock. As far as the Shelleys are concerned, so this was the evidence that the DPP classed as being dangerously unreliable. This was a couple who got invited back to the Prairie by Bailey and Jules Thomas. And at some point, Ian Bailey, to the slight consternation, I think, of the Shelleys, a little bit younger, took out a scrapbook of clippings on the crime, on the Sophie murder. And after, you know, leafing through these clippings in a scrapbook, Ian Bailey said, I did it, I went too far. By that time, he was in tears. He was hugging Mr. Shelley. The Shelleys were absolutely, absolutely shocked. The point is that the evidence given by the Shelleys to the guards should have been a matter for an Irish court. It's not for the DPP to say, oh, that's dangerously unreliable. I didn't find anything in the witness statements given by the Shelleys about that night, about that visit that they made to the Bailey household. I didn't find anything in that that was, at first sight, dangerously unreliable. So I really find it difficult to see how the DPP arrived at that conclusion.
Okay, now, let me give you an alternative view, Nick. The Gardaí, very early on, they identified Bailey. They decided they had their man, right? In February 1997, which was just 2 months after it, in a Garda report to the DPP, whom they were urging to prosecute him, they stated to the DPP that it was of the utmost importance that Bailey be charged immediately with this murder, as there is every possibility he will kill again. Now, that's putting pressure on the DPP. Okay, that kind of thing happens. However, in the DPP subsequent analysis, they interpreted that as follows, and this is what the DPP's office said. Ian Bailey was believed by the public, particularly in the local area, to be responsible for the murder. The fear engendered was bound to create a climate in which witnesses became suggestible. Now, within that context, and I have to say I've seen this in other Garda investigations, you have an atmosphere where witnesses are suggestible. Witnesses believe that they know who did it. They believe the Gardaí are trying to get this person. They, you know, there's an unconscious element there, possibly among some people. For example, the individuals whom he contacted before he was to have known about it. There's no solid evidence there. That was their recollection. Could a time, for instance, in a difference of 30 or 40 minutes, be as a result of a suggestible atmosphere? You have the 14-year-old boy. He went into school the next day and the Gardaí had visited the school doing nothing untoward on it, but on the basis of their investigations and that. He comes home and he has a version of what Bailey said to him. The Shelleys, there was a huge amount of alcohol consumed that night when he made those admissions. Similarly, the witnesses in the pub when he was there with the Bowron. Now, all I can say is I can't remember, you know, if I was in the pub last night, if somebody was playing a guitar or a Bowron or whatever, that I would noticeably know whether or not there was something unusual on their hands. It's not something that I would take notice of. So what you have from that person, and Maria Farrell, going back to Maria Farrell, let's discount that, which was the central thread, the only thing that in any realm of possibility connected Bailey to the scene was Maria Farrell, and that's completely discounted. So what you're left with is a number of witnesses, and I'm not disparaging them, all in good faith, I'm sure, that made various statements for the Gardaí and did so in, as the DPP described, what you might call a suggestible atmosphere in which there was a general consensus that Bailey was the man and that he better be locked up quick or somebody else could end up dead. In that context, Nick, I have to say, I don't find the DPP's decision unusual at all.
Well, look, I take your point that you could have a situation where an atmosphere in a community like that, I mean, this is going back in the day, of course, a fairly isolated community at the time, could be suggestible. But I don't see, first of all, the arguments that you're making are good arguments in favor of a trial in Ireland, because it's precisely the point of a trial to nail down the truth amongst all of the witness statements, all of the witnesses that presumably would have been called to attend court and to be subject to cross examination. So surely it would have been better if those witnesses would have had their claims tested. That's entirely the point. And another thing in parallel to that was a gentleman called Bill Fuller. Now you might remember that he did go to France and he did take the stand in the courthouse in France. And I found his evidence in Paris. I suppose it's the kind of evidence that he would have presented to court had he had a chance to do so in Ireland. But I found it entirely convincing. He didn't give the impression of being subject to suggestions or rumors in the local community, things that might turn him against Mr. Bailey. In fact, the impression I get in a general sense from the Garda file is of ordinary men and women in West Cork doing what they can, their civic duty, to assist the guards in their inquiries. And I don't get any sense at all in all of the witness statements that I went through several times that anybody had come forward with information that was bogus, testimony that was fraudulent, or even testimony that was somehow influenced by something in the air or rumours against Mr. Bailey, or even some kind of threats that Mr. Bailey might have made or others might have made. What I see in the language that was used and indeed the content of the testimony that's there in the file is people doing their civic duty. I don't see interference, but in any case, in any murder trial, it's for witnesses to be tested when they take the stand. It's for cross-examination to bring about an answer. And that's the problem, that the DPP quite simply, first of all, I think the DPP was hopelessly naive in the way that it dealt with these confessions, because the DPP said that it was likely that Mr. Bailey was engaging in what it called black humour, sarcasm. In other words, it was his reaction to all of these allegations that were being made, I mean, notably when he was arrested. I don't buy that for a minute. And what's interesting is, and I think it's a key point, is that none of the people who heard these confessions, Reed, the Shelleys, Fuller, none of these people understood it as being anything other than a confession. None of these people understood it as being black humour in any sense. And I'll just say one other thing on this, because I think we can also perhaps usefully broaden the scope of this. Are we really thinking that we've got an innocent man, there's a violent, terrible crime that happened a few short miles by where he lives, and that innocent man, who's already the prime suspect for that crime, goes around in a panic and tells people he's done it and he's innocent? I mean, that configuration of innocence, being a prime suspect and running around in a panic saying, I did it, it doesn't exist. I haven't found a single case worldwide of that kind of fantasy, that kind of fantasist. It simply doesn't exist. And it makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense for the DPP to think that it does exist. They should have let an Irish court decide on the validity of the testimony when it comes to Mr. Bailey's confessions. I'm absolutely clear on that.
Okay. I mean, I agree with you, Nick, in terms of the way Bailey conducted himself, and he was, as people describe it, a notice box, and he was somebody who enjoyed the notoriety. And I agree with you also that certainly, apart from the Garda investigation, nobody else has positively identified another suspect, somebody who could possibly have been there at the time. There was talk at one stage of somebody, Mr. Duplanty, having driven with somebody down from Cork Airport and that sort of thing. But nobody else has been identified. I agree with you on that.
Just and perhaps to defend Mr. Bailey in a sense. I mean, you know, nobody else has been identified. That doesn't mean to say it's Bailey. I mean, I think, you know what
I mean? I'm just putting it in context,
You know, he still has the right to say, well, just because just because I'm the only suspect doesn't mean to say it's me. It's true that it does. I should even jump in, to defend him from that point of view. But
I'm just putting it in the context, Nick, of why it adds to a general opinion as to why he might have been responsible.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Now, just coming back to some of the points you made about the DPP, you have to put this in context too. At the time, in terms of the DPP, the Gardaí, as to what I quoted you there, and it was perfectly obvious, they were really put, and they also had their allegations of political interference, they tried to put pressure on the DPP to bring a prosecution. The government would have been thrilled with a prosecution simply because they wouldn't have got any grief from the French and they wouldn't be put under any pressure there, and it gets rid of an issue. The public, as you said yourself and as the Gardaí said, largely believed he was guilty. The media, to a large extent, and a lot of their coverage at that time, I think it was before you or me were involved, came largely from Gardaí leaks. So the media were on board. So in that context, the fact that the DPP did not prosecute despite all of that pressure, despite it being the easiest thing in the world, I think speaks volumes for how they assess the evidence. One other quick thing, and you mentioned, and it's a very valid point you make, the evidence is there, why not let a jury decide? Well, we've had scenarios, and there's obvious ones, as in the likes of the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, people like that, who were put on trial on flimsy evidence at a time when a public mood, very understandably in Britain at the time after the IRA exploded bombs in public places and murdered dozens of people, very understandably there was a particular mood in the UK at the time that went, I would suggest, towards it making much easier to find these individuals guilty. Similarly, just a hypothetical example, let's say in 2008 in this country, I know there was an economic crash everywhere, but it was particularly bad in this country, in Ireland. Let's say a senior banker had been arrested for something and put on trial on very flimsy evidence. There's every possibility he would have been convicted, and that would be attributable to a certain extent to a huge public mood or whatever that there was at the time. So I think when you put that in context, both the pressure the DPP was under and the fact that the DPP has an obligation, not just to the victim, not just to the public, but also to a potential suspect, that if there is a trial, it is done on the basis of a threshold of evidence in as fair a way as possible. And I think the DPP came to the conclusion, not once but repeatedly, and different DPPs, they changed office in between, that that just was not possible.
Right. I mean, look, even Mr. Bailey wanted a trial. When I met him in November 2014, one of the first things he said to me was, I want a trial to clear my name. His partner wrote to the DPP saying that they were going through hell. The only way out of that hell was a trial. Marguerite Bouniel, Sophie's mother, wrote to the DPP begging for a trial. Pierre-Louis, Sophie's son, has repeatedly asked for a trial. So it's a rather odd situation where you have both the you know, the only suspect, you know, and the man who would be the defendant asking for a trial, his partner asking for a trial, the victim's mother asking for a trial, the victim's son asking for a trial. I think the truth is that when Bailey said to me that he wanted a trial, quote, to clear his name, to clear my name, was the words he used, I think there's a kind of an implicit understanding that there was a case, you know, was a case against him and he wanted to fight it. I just come back to this idea of a fair trial, though. Look, I really take your point, Mick. I really take your point. There was a feverish atmosphere in Skull. I wasn't there, but I mean, I spoke to many people and I can absolutely understand there was a feverish atmosphere in Skull in the days and weeks after the murder. There was a feverish atmosphere. Apart from anything else, it was the first murder they'd had there in many generations. So this was something entirely new. It was something awful. People were upset. But if there'd been a trial, it wouldn't have happened immediately. I mean, you know, it would have happened, you know, months and even years down the line. And so I'm not convinced that feverish atmosphere would have continued. And I do believe that the machinery of the Irish state would have put on a fair trial. And I think that the jurors would have been absolutely level-headed. And they looked at the evidence. They would have looked at the witnesses as well, since you brought those up. And they would have come to a conclusion. I can't predict what the conclusion is. It's not for me to say what that conclusion is to be. It's for an Irish court to come to a conclusion. It's none of my business. But there should have been a trial. There simply should have been a trial. Again, I think we're also in a position where I'm one of the privileged few who has access to the Garda file, and with that privilege comes a responsibility. Where I see that something went wrong, something here did go wrong. I think it's right to call it out. I think that that's my responsibility to call it out. But please understand that it's not a blanket accusation at the DPP. It's simply on this case, it's not structural, it's not systemic. I'm not saying that things went wrong elsewhere. In no way. What I am saying, though, is that in this particular case, they messed up. They made a mistake. There should have been a trial, in my view. But I'm well aware of the situations. I mean, I've read the file three or four times. I've come to that conclusion. I'm in a position of privilege because I've had the chance to read the file. Just one other quick point about this, because the Sophie's family, as you know, set up a justice committee called the ASOF in Paris, and they had access to the same documents. And I remember meeting them, Professor Gazou, for instance, who often appears in the media in Ireland. The people he had around him to look through the file when they got their hands on it, these people were scientists. They came from the scientific engineering community, and they were people who were interested in the detail of the file. They were absolutely interested in the detail of the file. They weren't jumping to any conclusions, and their view was there should be a trial because of what's in the Garda file. That was their view. It's exposure to the DPP file that leads you to think, or leads me to think certainly, and them, that there should have been a trial in Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, and just a couple of things, and you mentioned earlier, Nick, and I take completely, and I'm not suggesting for a second that any of the witnesses give bogus evidence or consciously attempted to mislead anyone. I'm sure that everybody acted in good faith. I'd have to definitely say that. Now, in terms of the French, and I take your point there and their reaction to it. However, both of us attended the trial in Paris, 5-day trial that was very quick. And I have to say, Nick, and I'd be interested in your opinion, in my opinion, it was a short trial. I mean, the quality of evidence there, for example, in one instance, a French detective gave evidence that he was in West Cork investigating. He met a Garda. The Garda told him Bailey did it. This was taken as evidence. In another element of it, a friend of Sophie's who was giving evidence 20 years after the event suddenly remembered, there was some trigger she suggested, but suddenly remembered that a few days before she was murdered, she told this friend that she'd met an English poet, which would suggest that, contrary to what Bailey said, that Bailey actually knew her. And you had other stuff like a psychologist who gave an opinion that Bailey had a borderline personality And he did this even though he never even met Bailey, not to mind interviewed him. The attitude to the witnesses, their witness list, two of the people on it were dead. They hadn't even checked that. Another was unfortunately suffering from dementia. They gave the witnesses a couple of weeks to come over and ask them to sort themselves out and they'd be reimbursed after. And to me, the whole thing just had the character of, we're going through the motions here in order to call him a convicted murderer, put in another extradition application, and that's it. And if anything, I would suggest that was a miscarriage of justice.
Well, look, I agree with you on several points there. And I must say, I've never come across a single person in Ireland who, even people who take my position on the evidence against Bailey, I've never come across a single Irish person who thought that that trial was satisfactory in any sense, either in its format or in the idea that a crime on Irish soil should be tried in a foreign jurisdiction. I'm entirely with you. I mean, I totally understand. I totally get it. And I understand as well the detail of the criticisms that you're making, Mick, about the trial. It seems strange, for instance, that we heard about that confession that Bailey made to the 14-year-old boy from his mother. I mean, that's no criticism, of course, of his mother who went over and did what she could, but it's unsatisfactory for that evidence to be presented in that way. As for the psychological assessments of Bailey that were drawn up by people who hadn't met him, I mean that speaks for itself. I don't think I need to say much more about that. The way in which we've already touched on the way in which Marie Farrell's initial evidence, if I can put it like that, was yeah, taken as being useful and treatable in court. I mean, I could go on. There were lots of problems. I don't think I would term it a show trial. I think that they do things differently in foreign countries, right? This was not, as you know, I mean, it wasn't a representative murder trial in any sense at all in France. Fundamentally, because Bailey wasn't there, they didn't have a defendant. Therefore, they didn't have the defence that the Bailey would have had the chance to put forward. So it was a kind of a prosecution only trial. And you remember, I think, you know, we had the chance to speak to representatives of the courthouse just before the trial started. And I went up to the guy and said, look, you know, tell me, I mean, how many trials do you have in absentia in France? He said, almost none. Very, very rare cases. Had there been a second trial, Bailey would have had a jury over there. I mean, the configuration of that trial was to do with the fact that they knew that they weren't going to get Bailey there to answer questions. They knew that he wouldn't be present. So I think, you know, I do get it. I share a lot of your misgivings. I really do. What I can say is, though, at the end, the as you remember, the French prosecutor said that the evidence against Bailey was overwhelming. By that, I understood that to mean the kind of evidence that was the evidence that was there in the Garda file, not the, let's say, additional things that came up solely in the Paris courtroom, including the rather late in the day recollection by one of Sophie's friends I think we can safely park those things and come back to the Garda file and the significant amounts of evidence that was in the Garda file that would have been the cornerstone of a trial in Ireland.
Okay. And look, it has to be said, and lest anybody think taking a position of defending Ian Bailey's character or anything, I'm doing absolutely nothing of the sort. There were aspects to the man that were deeply unpleasant, and one of the most harrowing things I heard over the course of all of this was in the 2003 libel trial, the evidence that was given by a third party of the extent of the injuries inflicted on Jules Thomas by Bailey one night he attacked her was absolutely harrowing by all accounts. But that of itself is a different matter as to whether or not he should have been put on trial here.
Could I just say, I don't think he should have been put on trial for that reason. I come back to the file, you know.
I'm not suggesting you do.
I mean, I feel I even have to you know, kind of jump in sometimes and defend his right to be, let's say, tried or the view that he should be tried on the evidence that's there In the I get it. And the piece, your piece in the paper this week, I found was really, really, really interesting. And I learned something about the point that you made, and you made it just a few minutes ago, that the Irish state would have been, you know, happy to see Bailey put on trial short months or within a year or two after the murder. It would have suited the Irish state. And I mean, I understand your point that the DPP's independence is underscored by the fact that it decided that there wasn't grounds to put Bailey on trial. Yeah, I get that. I mean, in the end, what looms very large to me again is the contents of the Garda file. It really is. It provides so much evidence that Bailey did it. And Bailey should have had the chance to defend himself in an Irish courtroom.
Right. No, and I mentioned everything just in terms of, as far as I was concerned, it went to his character and nothing to do with whether or not he had any responsibility for this particular murder. Nick, finally, at this stage, do you see anything possibly emerging that would either point to conclusively, anything significant that might point further to Bailey's guilt, or the alternative possibility that there may have been somebody else involved? Do you see anything else emerging at this very late stage?
No, look, can I just maybe deal with the question of somebody else involved? I mean, you know, it's Bailey himself within a few short days of the crime put out the theory that there was a quote French connection, that a killer had come over from France and did it. And can I just refute that in very clear terms? The first thing to say is that this last visit that Sophie made to Ireland was the very first time that she travelled on her own. So I calculate that she went to the house until more, perhaps 10 times, 12 times since she, you know, from the time she bought it. This was the very first time that she travelled there alone. It's funny, really, because sometimes she's portrayed as being kind of after the murder, she's portrayed in the press sometimes as being a kind of fairly solitary character. You know, she'd go to West Cork to kind of connect with her muse or something like that. She enjoyed being on her own, and that's not the case. But it's important in this connection. So this was the very first time she travelled there alone. How could a hitman have known that? How could somebody contracting hitman have known that? Her visit was planned only 3 or 4 days in advance. She had a business class ticket, you know, so she could have gone, you know, at any time or not gone at all. So again, how could that have been organised? How would anybody have set up that hit? Then you come to the murder weapon. I mean, what kind of hitman rocks up at the house of the target and no murder weapon. He simply looks down on the ground and, oh, there's a rock. I'll use that and I'll bash in the head of my victim 50 times. I mean, it doesn't happen like that. And finally, there was no motive at all. There was no motive at all for instance, Daniel Toscan du Plantier to murder his wife. The Bougnols, Sophie's parents, thought that patently absurd. So we can park that idea that somebody came over from France, and we can dismiss it out of hand. Anybody else? Anybody else in Ireland? Anybody else in West Cork? No, there weren't any other suspects. So again, all of this points in one direction. Bailey should have been put on trial. Now, what can be done? Not much. The trial in Paris that we were talking about, you know, that was ultimately a very hollow victory for Sophie's son. A very hollow victory for Sophie's son. Bailey wasn't extradited on the foot of that. Now, nothing at all, I'm afraid, can be done. I think that, you know, the chance has been missed. Years and years have gone by. The trial should have happened in Ireland. Ultimately, I think, you know, the documentaries, the books on the case, they all happened because, there was something there. You know, there was something there that needed to be decided transparently in a courtroom in Ireland. And now we're kind of just left with the, what are we left with? I mean, there's no defendant to take the stand. Bailey's not here. Yeah. There's nobody else. As far as I'm concerned, the the Garda cold case team, I mean, you know, didn't they pack up on Monday already and go home? I mean, there's nothing more for them to do. I think that the chance was missed. It's a crying shame. Yeah. It's a crying shame for Sophie's family that the chance was missed. They haven't been given justice, you know. They haven't got justice. And can you, I mean, just think about it for a minute. I mean, all these years ago, every single day, we're talking about thousands upon thousands of days, those poor elderly people, Sophie's parents, have woken up in the morning knowing that their beloved daughter is no longer there, but also knowing that she was murdered. Daniel Toscan Duplantier called it a double death in an interview with a French magazine. He said, it's one thing to lose your wife, to lose somebody you love, for her not to be here anymore. But it's a double death when you know that somebody wanted to wipe her off the face of the earth. It's a double death. He never came to terms with it. They never came to terms with it. Pierre Louis, you know, he's a middle-aged man. He was a teenager when his mother was murdered. He hasn't come to terms with it. He called the murder of his mother a handicap. He said, "It's always with me," and I saw it. I mean, I could see how much it affected him. But remember this: it affected him, and it affects him every single day of his life. The same for the parents. And I'm not suggesting, clearly, there's no way of bringing Sophie back, but they needed to have the chance for closure that a trial in Ireland would have given them.
Yes, very understandable. And you make a very valid point, Nick. The most important people in this are Sophie Toscan Duplantier's family. Jean-Pierre, her son, the one saving grace, as far as I was concerned, at the trial in Paris, he gave some of the most moving testimony I've ever heard from a victim in terms of the impact it had. You look at the stolen decades from that poor woman that she was robbed of by whomever murdered her and their family. There's absolutely no doubt they are the victims in the whole affair. And it, as you say, it seems unlikely there's going to be some conclusive outcome at this stage. Nick Foster, thank you very much for joining us today. Murder at Roaring Water, the inside story of the death of Sophie Toscan Duplantier, is Nick's book. And Nick, thanks very much for a very, very informative conversation. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks very much, Mick. Great being with you.
As always, I'd like to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening. Hang in there. We'll be back with you again next week.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.